clerk, you told me everybody was in place. Please be seated. This is Mountain View Hospital, Inquest District Court. Parties are ready to proceed. Please do so if you wish to reserve time. Please let us know how much.
John Bemis, on behalf of Mountain View Hospital, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. I believe that Ms. Weaver's going to be taking 3 minutes as well of the time.
Please proceed.
Your Honors, Justices. This is a medical malpractice case involving Mountain View Hospital and Dr. Garber. By way of quick background, Mrs. Rehfeld was admitted to Mountain View Hospital on December 17th of 2007. Thereafter, elective spinal surgery, she was discharged on December 19th of 2007. She was readmitted on January 1st, 2008. At that time, she was diagnosed with MRSA. Plaintiff submitted a medical malpractice complaint with the preliminary medical legal report of Dr. Bernard McNamara. This report is the subject of the petition. As this court obviously knows, NRS 41A.071 mandates that an affidavit of merit must accompany any complaint for medical malpractice. As this court issued an opinion in Washoe 2nd District, this court held that the shall be dismissed language of NRS 41A.071 mandates dismissal and does not give the court any discretion. Therefore, any medical malpractice complaint filed without the requisite affidavit is void ab initio and cannot be amended. Subsequently, in Buckwalter versus the 8th Judicial District Court, this court held that a 53.045 declaration under the penalty of perjury can suffice for an affidavit because the rule otherwise would render 53.045 meaningless. As such, we have two methods for a medical malpractice complaint to get past the pleading stage. And that is number one, to have an actual affidavit, and number two, to have a 53.045 declaration under the penalty of perjury. In furtherance of the affidavit requirement, this court granted a petition for writ of mandamus in Wolfson versus 8th Judicial District Court, where the petitioner challenged a district court decision wherein the court denied a motion to dismiss based on a letter being attached to the complaint for medical malpractice. This court granted the petition saying that the letter did not suffice for the affidavit requirement, and the court was mandated to dismiss the case. Currently, with the McNamara document, we have a case similar to Wolfson. Just like Wolfson, the real party in interest attaches a letter that does not comply with the requirement of NRS 41A.071. Plaintiffs do not allege that the McNamara document is a statement or a statement under the penalty of perjury per 53.045. Plaintiffs just declare that this is an actual affidavit. As such, this issue revolves solely around whether or not the December 15, 2008 document from Dr. McNamara is an affidavit. The Dr. McNamara document does not contain attestation to the truth of the contents of the document, nor does it have any sort of oath on the document itself.
Counsel,
it just has.
Do you have the site on Wolfson?
I don't have it right on my hand. I can pull it up here in a moment.
Okay.
With regard to the McNamara document, it just has the California all-purpose acknowledgement. And if you take a look at the acknowledgement itself, the notary public certifies three things in that acknowledgement. Number one, the notary public certifies that Dr. McNamara appeared in L.A. County on December 15, 2008. Number two, the notary public certified that Dr. McNamara provided sufficient evidence to prove that he was the individual identified in that document. And number three, the notary certified that Dr. McNamara executed that document. Those are the only three things that the notary certified. And if you take a look at the acknowledgement, it is the same acknowledgement that is codified in California Civil Code 1189.
Now, does the subsequent declaration of Dr. McNamara save this? Indicated in his subsequent declaration that the notary public, in fact, administered an oath, and he verified that the contents of the preliminary medical legal report were true and correct.
and that was done as a result of this petition. At the time of filing the complaint, there's nothing in that document which shows that an oath was taken, nor does it show that Dr. McNamara subscribed and swore under the penalties of perjury to the truth of those of that document. And if you compare the acknowledgement to Section 8802 of the California Civil Code, which defines a jurat, it says if an affidavit is subscribed and sworn in front of a notary public in California, a jurat must be included. Now, the differences between the acknowledgement and the jurat is one important aspect of this, and it's the fact that within a jurat, the notary public actually states an oath was given. That's a certification given by the notary public. And in this case, the California all-purpose acknowledgement that we have in front of us here, there is no certification that an oath was given. And if you look at the contents of the document itself, there is no attestation that he was under oath or that he asserts that everything was true.
But subsequently, he says he declares under the penalty of perjury that he, in fact, was administered that oath.
Correct. He does state that subsequently. But if you take a look at the fact that both petition, myself and Real Party in Interest submit to this court has never given an opinion as to the sufficiency of an affidavit.
Is this something we should allow?
Is which something? The subsequent? Then any letter, any sort of document that is filed can subsequently be cured, and it's an amendment per 15A. Because you got to take a look at the time. This is a gatekeeping mechanism. It's so that frivolous suits are not filed. I know that the Washoe Court states basically that there are harsh consequences to this ruling, but it does cut with a clean, sharp edge. And this time, it's at the time of the filing of the complaint of whether that constitutes an affidavit. Now, if you take a look at...
Well, this factual pattern is a little bit different than a letter, because at least there is a notary present.
Correct.
With the letter that the doctor supplied. And so, as I understand the doctor's subsequent affidavit, he's adding factual information saying that at the time that the notary swore to my name on the document, they also administered an oath. So that isn't necessarily an amendment. He's simply supplying evidence of what transpired in connection with the document, confirming that an oath was administered. Why shouldn't we permit that?
Well, the missing piece would be from the notary public herself. Because the notary public herself is the individual that would give the oath to the individual.
Well,
further,
I mean, I don't know why the physician couldn't also offer that testimony. It would be up to the district court judge to make an assessment as to whether the statements made by the physician were pursuant to an oath. You've made a point in your briefing, if I understand the argument, that at the end of the day, one of the litmus tests here is whether or not what the doctor said would make him subject to perjury.
Correct.
And so if the doctor admits in an affidavit that he was sworn at the time he made the statement, would not that subject him to a claim for perjury if he stated falsely?
Well, the litmus test is a little different than that. It's actually whether the document itself, whether this document itself can be hold him to the penalties of perjury. Now, in this document itself, there is no statement of oath. In this document itself, there is no attestation to the truth of the contents of the document. In this document itself, there is no stating that it's signed under the penalty of perjury. And the notary public in this document does not acknowledge that an oath was given. And if you take those together, then how can Dr. McNamara be convicted of perjury based on that document itself? And that is the litmus test, is does the document in itself subject the individual to the penalties of perjury? And trust that if any district court saw that this document and said, I want to convict Dr. McNamara of perjury in this instance, that would not happen.
Counsel, if you wish to reserve 3 minutes as well as 3 minutes additionally for counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would just like to briefly add that the facts and arguments apply equally to my client, Dr. Garber, and Dr. Garber Limited. And I would concur, unless there are questions, with my co-counsel with regard to his arguments. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Roger Gritteau for the Real Party in Interest. Difficult case, difficult issues, unfortunately, because some of these cases were being decided at the same time this case was already going on. But I submit that, and as the court has asked questions of counsel, is that this is a different case than everything that's been decided thus far. Washoe, the Washoe decision, absolutely no affidavit of any kind filed. Didn't meet the statute at all. Buckwalter, candidly, no affidavit filed at all within the terms of an affidavit. However, it was considered a declaration to be sufficient pursuant to Section 53045 of NRS. So that was okay. There was a Borger decision, B-O-R-G-E-R decision. The court's heard and argued before and had it before the court. Same sort of situation. The affidavit was deemed to be late filed and therefore not adhered to. The interesting thing, though, is in all of these cases, and the statute is very, very clear. All right? In 41A, it says, without an affidavit, in its complete absence, without. What we have now is an argument as to whether or not an amendment may be had to add the words, literally add the words, subscribed and sworn. That's really what we're arguing about. We're really arguing about whether or not a medical professional who's been hired, paid as an expert, rendered medical opinion that was, all due respect to the judicial system, would be hard to prosecute him for perjury anyway. It's his medical opinion as to a condition. But be that as it may, he has been rendering his medical opinion as a result of records. He's provided a full record review. He gives a reasonable degree of medical probability opinion as to the degree of medical malpractice, if you will. And that's the determination, that's the rendering of that. He goes to and has a notary for the sole purpose of taking that oath and making sure that it is, in fact, a statement, a properly presented statement. And instead, it comes back with a all-inclusive acknowledgement as opposed to something that says subscribed and sworn before. The real problem, though, one of the problems is there anywhere in the statute that it says it needs to say it in the affidavit? And I submit to you that in the Buckwalter decision,
without it, is it truly an affidavit?
I think it is, Your Honor. And I think it is because it depends on what, in fact, the affiant is saying and what the affiant is saying he's responsible for and what the affiant is understanding his obligation.
But without a penalty of perjury attached to it, is it truly reliable and considered an affidavit? Pursuant to the sense of the word.
I understand. And pursuant to the legislative history and pursuant to the whole reason for the affidavit process in the Med-Mal cases, as we all know, we got rid of the medical screening panel in 2002. And the whole purpose of this was to be a gatekeeper, and I agree with counsel. The idea was to make sure that we had a fair case filed, making sure it was done in good faith, and it was backed up by a medical professional within the specialty to opine this to the medical malpractice. Simple statement. Now, as far as the technical definition of the affidavit, if we apply the technical definition of the affidavit, the affiant swore in writing, all right, before an authorized person, meaning a notary in the state of California, and I cited you to that statute. All aspects of this were in fact done correctly, except the words subscribed and sworn were not included in the affidavit. The real question for this court, I think, and I apologize if I take that liberally, is to decide whether or not it needs to be said in that manner, and secondarily, whether or not it cannot be amended. This court, specifically, in its Borger decision, And I think the Borger decision is particularly instructive. I apologize. I think it's particularly instructive because in the exact language of the Borger decision, and again, it was dismissed obviously as a result of not having an appropriate affidavit, but it said, our resolution of the basic affidavit requirement does not end this analysis. A different problem of interpretation will arise in the event of a legitimate dispute over whether a filed affidavit of merit complies with the statute. Because NRS 41A071 contains no explicit prohibition against amendments, and because legislative changes in the substantive law may not unduly impinge upon the ability of the judiciary to manage litigation, we conclude that the district court, with its sound discretion in considering the need for judicial economy, may grant leave to amend malpractice complaints supported by disputed affidavits under circumstances where justice so requires. I believe that's this case. I believe that justice so requires. This is a very, 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 with all due respect, I hope the justices agree with me, but I find it to be a very minor omission. And it was an omission where the affidavit is done out of state, it's presented by a doctor getting it signed out of state, and it's sent in. It was cured timely. It was cured in, the complaint was filed basically in December, they were cured in early January and one in February. Again, way, way before this ever started, because we amended the filing.
Cured in what way?
Well, the amendment, Your Honor, would be that it was signed on the pains and penalties of perjury after that. And
which
would
was
be
March of 7th of 11?
No, Your Honor. Got it.
Oh, okay.
No, January of 09, Your Honor. And if the court will, I don't have it in front of me, and I apologize, I can cite you to it in a moment, but essentially what happened was both affidavits were submitted back to the court with language at the end of it, and re-signed, of course, and re-notarized, that said it's being signed on the pains and penalties of perjury. Okay, and that language was, in fact, done, and that language was, in fact, added. The real question is whether or not that amendment's appropriate. The counsel's argument is one somewhat draconian, but it says that the court has no jurisdiction to allow an amendment of a filed pleading, and it has no ability to allow an ambiguous affidavit to be amended for clarification. That's essentially the issue. Okay, there's no question that it comported with all requirements of an affidavit, candidly, all requirements of a declaration, all right, under Buckwalter, by the latest February 9th on Ms. Wyckoff's, and by January 29th, I believe, of Mr. McNamara, Dr. McNamara. So there's no issue there. And then subsequently, we filed the clarification, if you will, as to whether or not he was sworn at the time he originally did the affidavit, being a second leg of analysis. So this isn't just the first leg, it's the second leg. Now, what's interesting is even in our case law, in our NRS statutes, if you look at NRS 53045, it tells you the language needs to be in the document, specifically stated. All right, it needs to be in the language. However, it doesn't say that under our statute for affidavit. There is no statute for affidavit. Okay, there is nothing that tells you what an affidavit is except going to Black's Law Dictionary or some other case law which this court's decided. And candidly, the court has rendered, obviously, opinion in the past on what an affidavit is. So I'm not dissuading that, but I'm simply saying that there's not a specific definition within the NRS. Now, the real question is, we have statutes on the books, for example, NRS 111-365. It's just regarding an affidavit for joint tenancy, but in there it says that the affidavit has to be sworn and subscribed to. It doesn't say that with respect to the affidavit required for 41A in our case. There's an additional section under 463A, subsection 102, use of affidavits at hearings. Doesn't say they have to be subscribed and sworn to. But in certain cases, it is stated. So when we get into the Buckwalter analysis and the Buckwalter reasoning is, we were going to look both of these statutes square in the eye and make them comport in harmony. And the harmony being that if we're going to argue both of these statutes, they both need to have interplay. And our position, again, first position is we've done it correctly. We've at least had the opportunity, and he was sworn at the time. It just didn't say it in the affidavit. We then assert that the court has jurisdiction. In this case, certainly under the Borger decision in terms of what the dicta was in that case, and it really wasn't dicta, it was in the body of the text, but it was a discussion of what was anticipated by this court. And candidly, this court has seen this issue before. I know the court's ruled on it. It is somewhat a moot issue in the state. It has not been decided upon yet. There's no question that it carries all the indicia of reliability. There's no question that, and I don't think that's been alleged. There's no question it's not real medical opinion. There's no question that it was falsely asserted to. It's simply whether or not it said subscribe in its form. Because the physician has put under pains and penalties of perjury, again, back in, a month after the petition was filed, original complaint was filed. He says it under pains and penalties of perjury there. Ms. Wyckoff says it under pains and penalties of perjury. And then he offered the affidavit for this court again, if this was remanded back, what the testimony would be in this matter as to whether or not he was under oath at the time he made his statements. Obviously, I mean, these are major, major issues, and I think that based upon the way the court has gone so far, I think it's appropriate that this be allowed. At least the court needs to have some mobility. If the court, and I say this from the trial court's point of view, if the trial court is left with absolutely no ability to manage a case and manage a minor defect, it really becomes to a unreasonable outcome. I mean, hypothetically speaking, what if the document was destroyed? Can we replace the document? We have electronic filing these days. What if the last page didn't get on? Is that a defective affidavit? Technically speaking, it would be. All right. So, I mean, I believe that in all due respect, the trial courts, as the trial court did in this case, exercise reasonable discretion.
So the point of your argument is that the parties should be permitted to demonstrate as of the filing date that the document that was attached to the complaint complied, so that if there is some deficiency, you'd be able to present evidence to demonstrate compliance.
I think that at a minimum, Your Honor, yes. That would be my position. It's also my position, however.
Well, I'm not sure that allowing you to substitute an affidavit as you did in January complies with what the court has talked about in Washoe and Buckwalter and Borger, at least the intent. Because the focus has been on what is the status of the complaint as she exists on the date she's filed. Because the Washoe case clearly says anything short of that, it's void.
I realize that, Your Honor. And the thing about the Washoe
case. So your argument is, well, the affidavit we submitted in March demonstrates that we were in compliance.
On the day of.
On the day of.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And then the argument with the respect of the January, if you will, and the February 09 of night filings is we're saying that the court should have jurisdiction, at least ability, to manage its dockets and fix if there's any minor imperfections. Washoe, Buckwalt was a different case, but Washoe had no complaint, no affidavit whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And in most of the cases up to that point, the court had dealt with had no affidavits or timely filed affidavits, let's put it that way, of any kind. The complaint would be filed on one day, and then 3 months later, the affidavit. So I do think that there is two levels to this argument. I clearly agree that that's our position. I also, for the sake of practicing in this
sure.
court system for many, many years, I think the courts need jurisdiction to at least address these issues at the trial court level. And that's my only comment to that. It's more of, not that we didn't comply, because I think we did, and that's my first line of argument. But my second line of argument is, I do believe that the court has jurisdiction, or should have jurisdiction.
I guess the point I was trying to make, I appreciate your point, but I'm not sure that I think that it bumps up against our jurisprudence. So how do we reconcile that?
Which portion?
Allowing amendment and substitution of the previously defective affidavit.
Well,
let's suppose that the facts in your case are not that the doctor, as he indicates in his affidavit now, was sworn at the time he made the statements by the notary, but instead simply submits, I say simply, but submits a substitute affidavit that is now in compliance with the statute.
And I think that goes back to 41A071, which is the subject of this issue. And what it says is if the action is filed without an affidavit. All right. Now, without obviously means without. Now, the argument they're making is without a technically correct affidavit, because in all respects, it had all of the other indicia of reliability. It was written, it was signed, it was before a person authorized to give the oath, and a person authorized to witness that oath. And then I cite the court, at least my position would be, I cite the court back to the Borger decision, where the court itself recognized this issue could potentially come up with the, if you will, it talked about the meritus affidavit. Well, meritus didn't mean fully complying. It meant, at least the way I would interpret that, meaning that all good faith carried all of the indicia of reliability, was a good faith attempt to comply and to make sure it was done correctly, timely filed. Not late, but timely filed.
What if it was wholly insufficient?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What if it was wholly insufficient?
And if it's wholly insufficient, we lose.
Well, why can't it be amended under your argument?
But that's exactly... I apologize. Let me...
No, go ahead.
But that's exactly the issue, Your Honor. My position with that is it should be up to the trial court judge at least to have some discretion to figure out whether or not it's wholly insufficient and possibly to hold a hearing for that. I mean, that happens all the time in many, many cases. If we have issues that require judicial discretion, they hold a hearing. We deduce evidence to figure out whether or not it's reasonable in the circumstances.
Counsel, it makes it easier for the trial court if we have strict compliance. But what is your argument as to substantial compliance, and where will we draw the line?
Here. Well, I say here. I mean, you need to have, first off, we need to have something that's filed timely. All right? And this would be probably the only second case that was filed timely that the courts addressed. I mean, you addressed Buckwalter, and you addressed the decision we just had. I apologize. I can find it. But where it was just basically a signed statement. Those two cases have been addressed. Now, obviously, one case flopped the other way because it was simply a letter. This case, in fact, has a juror. Well, it's not, pardon me, it doesn't have a juror. It has an acknowledgment. All right. It is signed in front of a person authorized to give the oath. And then we're alleging, and it's not my testimony, it's the doctor's testimony, that he was placed under oath and was doing this under pains and penalties of perjury and was doing so with the intent of offering this as evidence to a court with full knowledge that that's what was going to happen. Now, the question is, at least from my perspective, whether or not that's so defective to basically dump this medical malpractice case, because that's essentially what it does. So the question is whether or not it gives rise to that level of, you know, inability, if you will, to make any amendments, corrections, or clarifications. Because that's really what we're talking about, is a clarification. All right? If it's all done at timely time, and it's filed timely, which this was, the issue is whether or not I can present evidence to the court that it was sworn under oath, which would technically comply. And then the real truth is whether or not there is requirement within the document that it has to be say, that it has to say on that face of the document, subscribed and sworn. I mean, that is a question. Now, obviously, an affidavit needs to be subscribed and sworn, and I understand that. But the question is whether or not it needs to be written in the document. I didn't find that anywhere. It doesn't say that anywhere in most of the documents I've gone through, except in some of the cases, in some of the statutes where it says, in fact, it needs to say that. It doesn't say that in this particular case. I think that's somewhat instructive as well, again, going back to the Buckwalter analysis, if you will.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Counsel, you have in excess of 3 minutes. You're at 5:23, so you have time.
Essentially, the litmus test here is at the time of filing. As we've discussed, at the time of filing, what is the document that's attached to the complaint? Now, in Wolfson, which I don't have the site, but I do have the opinion if you'd like to. In Wolfson, it was the letter that was attached. Well, the same question that Real Partner Interest is asking.
Well, my question was it an opinion or an order?
It was an order granting a petition.
Well, that was the reason I asked you for the site, because under the rules of professional conduct, it's improper for you to argue and cite to an unpublished opinion.
I apologize.
So I kind of remembered the case, and I'm wondering what's up with that.
I understand.
That's really not something you should be doing.
With regard to the McNamara document itself, now in the briefing, Real Party Interest goes into the California law and goes into the Sheely decision. And in the Sheely decision, it talks about the verification of the pleading. And in that verification, there was a problem with the acknowledgement, with the juret being attached to it. And it didn't specify correctly what the acknowledgement was. And in California, what they said is we need to take a look at the verification itself. And if that verification says that itself then puts this person under the penalty of perjury, then it fits with the affidavit requirement. With regard to this right now, if we allow amendment of the affidavit or extra evidence 4 years down the road of whether the person was under oath or not, then we could potentially be undoing 7 years of jurisprudence on this issue itself.
But counsel, you're within that last argument that you made. You referred to it as an affidavit. If it is an affidavit, then why does it not meet the requirement and allow then for a substantial compliance analysis opposed to a strict?
Well, I don't believe that it's a strict compliance analysis. It's whether or not the document itself would subject the person to penalty of perjury. Now, if the person attests under penalty of perjury, or there's enough evidence together from the document itself that the person says, I duly hereby swear. Now, the jurat itself would just be an acknowledgement of that by the notary public. But the person, if they put, I here do by swear after solemnly taking an oath, then that shows that in the document itself that there was an oath given.
Mr. Bemis, has our jurisprudence foreclosed the ability of the plaintiff to resolve a problem, say, in an electronic filing case where a page of the opinion, or maybe even the page that the doctor signed, doesn't get attached, and a motion is brought and says the attachment's defective under the statute. The response is, well, wait a minute, for whatever reason, the whole document reflects that the doctor signed it was under oath, and otherwise complies. Does our jurisprudence prevent a party from demonstrating compliance?
I believe that Washoe does prevent that because of the fact that that is a complaint that's filed without an affidavit.
I guess what concerns me about that is that the plaintiff then would be put at risk of having being able to comply with the statute for a fault of the clerk, for example, or someone else unrelated to the plaintiff or their lawyer. That seems unjust.
It does, but in Washoe it does say that there are harsh consequences with this.
But at least in your view, the Washoe opinion forecloses any ability of the plaintiff to demonstrate that the filed document is incomplete through some mistake by someone.
Absolutely, because there has been cases in the 8th Judicial District where there have been cases where an individual omits having an affidavit attached when they sent it down with the runner. The next day it gets filed. Motion to dismiss is granted because it's not foreclosing the opportunity because it's granted without prejudice.
Yeah,
person has the opportunity
the
to refile.
Statute of limitations consequence that applies. Yeah.
And that's, you know, the plaintiff's decision on what timely filing it. I'm going to leave Mr. Weaver with the last, unless there's any other questions. Thank you.
Your Honors, if I might point out that I think that counsel for Real Party has pointed out and framed to some degree, I believe correctly, the issue that what's before us is whether or not the letter has the opportunity to be cured. And I think that the discussion about curing it is to some degree an admission that perhaps it was not, in fact, an affidavit at all. Otherwise, it would not need to be cured. And I think that given the additional documentation to cure the document is, in fact, the same as doing an amendment, which I think is pretty clearly not accepted under the jurisprudence. And therefore, it is the equivalent of an amendment. And I think that the statute is pretty clear that if the affidavit is not, in fact, meeting all the elements of an affidavit, that it cannot later be cured, it must be dismissed. And while the remedy may be harsh because there may be consequences with the statute limitations, that is the remedy that the legislature has set forth in the event that for whatever reason the pleading requirements are not met. So there is a remedy that the legislature anticipated may be necessary if strict compliance did not occur. occur, and the fact that that remedy under the circumstances of this case or other cases may not be adequate to save the case, quite frankly, is not the fault of the defendants. If I might add, Your Honor, to distinguish a little bit in your hypothetical, I think it is a little bit different where through the fault of no one, especially the plaintiff, there may be a defective complaint because for whatever reason the electronic filing system or a court clerk or otherwise unrelated to anything under the control of the plaintiff. I think that would be potentially different. I don't think there is any jurisprudence on it, but in this case, the filing of the affidavit attached to the complaint was solely and entirely within the purview and the responsibility of the plaintiff. It just simply wasn't adequate, and it was subsequently cured because it wasn't adequate. And that is the same, in effect, as an amendment that might be filed because the elements of the allegations were not sufficient in the first place. Thank you very much.
Anything additional? Thank you. We thank counsel for the arguments. This matter was of interest because it is a new nuance for the court. With that, this matter will stand submitted. Thank you.